on the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO. Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I'd like to continue to read to you from my conversion memoir entitled An American Conversion, One Man's Discovery of Beauty and Truth in Times of Crisis. As von Balthasar said in the preface to the first volume of his The Glory of the Lord, quote, "Whoever sneers at beauty's name as if she were the ornament of a bourgeois past, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love." It was certainly true in my own case that these many encounters led to my ultimate conversion. All the hundreds of books that I read, the hours of music that I heard, the conversations, the arguments, the disputes, friends lost and gained, the years of uncertainty and doubt, all were grounded in particular moments of inarticulate vision. In the experience of beauty, there are three elements present. Most casual conversations about beauty fail to distinguish between them, and confusion usually results. First, there is the object of beauty itself. Then there is the subject, that is, the viewer, who sensually perceive beauty. And finally, there is the relationship that is created between the object and the subject. The subject of aesthetic experience can be further subdivided into those who create objects of art and those who experience the audience. Most of what I can say about beauty and my conversion is confirmed to my experience of it, but I don't believe that this relegates me to subjectivism. In the experience of beauty, we are responding to the perception of form in objects or actions. That form is attractive to the human mind because it displays order and clarity in the midst of the world's complexity. In beauty, the mind glimpses the handiwork of mind, or as Dorothy Sayers would put it, we observe, quote, the mind of the maker. The ecstatic experience that is at the heart of seeing the beautiful, that delicious moment of going outside oneself, is a response to the ecstasy of creation, whether creation by the human or the divine artist. The creator moves outside of himself, that is in ecstasy, by making an object conform to an inner vision or intuition. Thus, beauty is made possible by intelligence, both in the subject who sees it and the artist who makes what we delight in. It is often said in the tradition of St. Thomas and the Neoplatonists that beauty is one of the transcendental attributes of being itself. Beauty as a transcendental is never perceived directly any more than any other transcendental can be known, such as the good and the true. However, the experience of finite beauty is undoubtedly grounded in the transcendental beauty that belongs to all being. Transcendent beauty, like transcendent goodness, persists regardless of the destructive forces of ugliness or evil. Just as Satan himself retains the goodness of his being, as St. Thomas teaches, he also retains the beauty of his existence. To be trumps not to be. This explains why beauty has the power to convert. To say this may belabor the obvious to most people, we all know that beauty is used to sell any and all products. We all know that personal beauty is one of the greatest advantages in life and disadvantages. We all know that beauty gets our attention, keeps it, and lifts our spirit and distracts us from the boredom of everyday life. So to ask why beauty converts is to raise a question that really lies at the heart of our everyday experience. We can all agree that beauty attracts our attention because beauty, by definition, is that which delights the senses. In fact, this is the classic definition of beauty given by St. Thomas Aquinas. Being delightful, beauty immediately becomes the object of our appetite and will. That is, beauty appears to us as desirable under the form of the good, that which is desired. Herein, of course, lies the danger of beauty. Its experience leads us out toward the possibility of embracing some new, perhaps destructive, object of love. Let it be said quite clearly that not all conversions are for the good. Beauty does not necessarily serve the angels. The moral meaning of beauty is intrinsically ambiguous, which is to say beauty can lead us to heaven or to hell. I think that despite this ambiguity, there is a strong impulse within the experience of beauty itself that is in line with Plato's teaching in the Symposium. Plato taught any experience of beauty opens a wound in us that can be healed only by another contact, but with a greater beauty, a beauty higher than the physical beauty. In other words, aesthetic experience can be, from a moral perspective, self-correcting. That is, one higher beauty can correct a lower beauty. This is not an argument I'm prepared to develop at length here or even defend. But I do think the understanding of beauty as proposed by Aquinas and later Thomas puts the person who develops a genuine critical appreciation for the beautiful at an advantage in the search for ultimate reality. When Satan, for example, uses beauty to seduce us away from God, he is using that which belongs to God. He is disordering that which is fundamentally ordered to the Creator. Beauty converts us because it attracts. It elicits our desire. And it makes us yearn for unity within itself. Beauty converts us because in unifying ourselves with it, we become new. This is why we always must take care in what we choose to love. Or perhaps better to say, what we are moved to love. Because what we love will change us over time. Given my perspective, you'll understand if I say bad taste is no little matter. Bad taste leads us to a union with things that can diminish us, a union through affectivity. Bad taste, in fact, is a habit of clinging to what may defile, demean, and diminish us. Our entertainments are not, in short, trivial pursuits. In telling this story of beauty and conversion, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Ideal Hudson, convert to the Catholic faith, once 20 years ago underwent a series of experiences that led me to convert. I would rather leave you with the impression that I have been blessed with a constant experience of conversion, one that began in a dramatic way, worthy perhaps of this public telling. But if any of us, whether converts or not, ever stop converting, then we have all fallen short of the vision we originally received. Chapter 16, Beauty Will Save the World. One of the characters in Dostoevsky's novel, The Idiot, says, "Beauty will save the world." This was clever of Dostoevsky. By saying it through one of his characters, he didn't have to defend it. I'm going out on a limb to say precisely that. Beauty will save the world. And I will have to defend it against those who find it objectionable. But how do you defend a proposition that is not, strictly speaking, demonstrable? I must admit that my certainty in this matter is grounded in experience, my own and that of many others who have found the lure of beauty irresistible. Thus, the defense of beauty does not consist of an aesthetic. It requires storytelling, one after another, of beauty's saving effect. To this, the skeptic will declare, "You believe that beauty will save the world because you are saved by beauty." Of course, what I believe about my own experience doesn't prove anything in itself, and, to make matters worse, even though it's my experience, I cannot be sure in telling my story that I am telling the entire truth. We have no privileged access to knowing ourselves. The soul, as Aquinas said, cannot look at itself directly. I may be deceived. What may make my story convincing to others is that others may recognize themselves in it, or they may recognize something they aspire to. The story may help in the daunting task of acquiring self-knowledge. I have found that the lure of beauty, so to speak, has been the pivot point for many conversion stories of all kinds across the ages. So what I offer here is neither a metaphysics of beauty nor a theological aesthetics. This is a story of my unexpected and unsought encounters with beautiful things that ultimately led me beyond them. The lure of beauty has been recognized in the tradition of Christianity again and again. For me, it was Jacques Maritain who first opened my eyes to it, but it's the comprehensive work of the late Hans-Urs von Balthasar, whose majestic The Glory of the Lord has made theological reflection on beauty finally acceptable again. But these exercises, as the reader will see, are not uniform. They do not unfold systematically or even chronologically. My conversion cannot be summarized as a reading of texts or encounters with music and poetry. My life, I hope, doesn't consist of a series of reviews. In Plato's Symposium, Socrates presents the view that experience of finite beauty creates a continual hunger for continuous, infinite beauty. The beauty of the body leads to the beauty of the soul and onward to the beautiful itself. If conversions always resulted accordingly, one would be led from, say, Bach's B minor Mass toward the God who is praised in the composer's music. But the effect of beauty on the restless soul is often not that straightforward. For example, many will recall that beauty played an important role in Augustine's conversion. Augustine became conscience-stricken when he realized that his emotional reaction to suffering on a stage was greater than his response to the same suffering in real life. This led him to examine his dependence on sensual enjoyment and look within for the immaterial traces of God's presence. Whereas Augustine's soul was pricked by his emotional reaction to works of the imagination, as opposed to the world he lived in, mine was stirred by guilt about being drawn to the world of beauty at all, a world deeply distrusted by my evangelical brothers. The religious leaders I knew would have regarded Dostoevsky's statement, "Beauty will save the world," as trite as best, and it were superficial and morally irresponsible. These moralists regard beauty only as an occasion of sensual sin, a temptation to disregard the true things of the spirit. Part of the story I have to tell is how I overcame what I felt was a religious prohibition against beauty, a prohibition that I found antithetical to the full glory of God's grace. In this, I was aided most of all by the Catholic novel. To the religious reader wary of the aesthetic, the novel has the advantage of being content-rich about human life. Reading a Catholic novel, you are reading about God and humankind, heaven and hell, sin and forgiveness. You can be assured that the act of reading is not the wasteful effort of a carnal mind. Chapter 17, Catholic Novels. Reading Saint Jose Maria Escrivá has made many a saint. In my own case, it has merely made a convert, but I do continue to read ever more deeply into the mystery that is the Church. Thomas Merton started on his road to the Church with the accidental discovery of Etienne Gilson's The Spirit of Medieval Philosophy in the Columbia University Library. We are foolish to forget the power of the written word. As I moved toward the Church, my reading prodded me onward with a series of vaguely related insights. Although I understood only a little of the content of the Catholic faith, I knew that it explained the limitations of the Christian traditions, both liberal Protestant and evangelical, in which I was raised. It would take me years to pass through my own period of protest and grasp the inner coherence of the Church herself. I was a young college professor then, and still reeling from the effect of the Catholic bomb sent to me by Raz Smoleva, my friend, when I began to read Catholic novels one after another. By the time I finished this assignment, luckily I had wise and tasteful tutors, I would not have dreamed of turning back. There are, in fact, Catholic novels, though certain learned people dispute the fact. I have no comprehensive definition of the Catholic novel, neither would I ever attempt one. However, I happily name a novel as Catholic when it presents to the reader a narrative that embodies some substantial aspect of the Catholic faith. In other words, a Catholic novel is one that ably suggests to the reader moments of insight where we catch a glimpse of God's ineluctable providence, as in, for example, The Diary of a Country Priest by George Baranos, so that readers then become pilgrims. It is said that people don't read much anymore, that we live in a multimedia age, and that the act of reading is on the wane, and that's not true. I never took these prognostications seriously. Nothing is ever to replace reading as the most intimate medium of enjoyment and self-examination. When we want to change a person's life, we still give that person a book, and we wait, hoping. As you've seen, I had been raised in a Protestant home and had become an ardent Southern Baptist in college before attending Princeton Theological Seminary. There I read the greats, Luther, Calvin, Barth, Tillich, and the Niebuhrs. I began to realize that the first principle of Protestantism, ridding the faith of idolatry, had gone so far as to undermine Christian intelligence. My Catholic bomb was packed with many spiritual and theological books from the great Dominican Guérigou Lagrange and Maisie Ward on G.K. Chesterton to the simple verse of St. Francis of Assisi. With every book, a strong impression received years earlier when I had read St. Augustine's On the Trinity was confirmed. Catholic Christianity embodied the fullness of God's revelation without the narrowing refractions of other younger Christian communions. The first principle of Catholicism was indeed the Incarnation, and that centrality is shown through all my reading. Thus, if there is a litmus test for the Catholic novel, it must be whether the novel is capable of conspiring in spiritual conversion. Even if one bears in mind that conversion is ongoing, not at all confined to a Damascus Road experience, this test flies in the face of most aesthetic niceties about the freedom of the writer, the novel, and the audience. It goes without saying that authors who consciously intend to convert their readers probably will end up doing a poor job. That's the trouble with avid readers, like myself, giving in to speculations. We risk encouraging the worst habits of young novelists. Among the novelists that led me to the church, I want to recommend the following. Evelyn Waugh, who wrote Brideshead Revisited. If there is another novel that wears its moral consciousness as lightly as Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited, I don't know it. Perhaps that's why it works so well. Like Charles Ryder himself, the reader is slowly and slyly seduced into the Catholic undercurrents of the aristocratic Marchmain family. The long final coda of Lord Marchmain's death, his sign of the cross, and the repentant confession of Julia on the staircase distill the choice we must all finally make for or against God. As Julia puts it, in refusing to leave her husband for Charles, quote, "I saw today there was one thing unforgivable, the bad thing I was on the point of doing, that I'm not quite bad enough to do, to set up a rival good to God's." Then there's the novel by the French-American writer Julian Green, The Other One. It's a novel that not many know. Not many people know Julian Green, for that matter, but it's a great one and deserves to be read. Julian Green was born of a Protestant mother from Savannah, Georgia, and a French Catholic father. And he has riveted my attention for many, many years. Although his novels like Moira, perhaps his best known, and Each in His Own Darkness, better known, it was the obscure The Other One that left its deepest mark on me. This novel, more than any other I know, depicts the hunger for God as the source of all human appetites. I would later recognize this unquenchable desire with its rich moral implications in Aquinas' Anthropology. But first I met it in Julian Green. Set in Copenhagen, the story follows a recently converted man who returns to a woman he had mistreated some years earlier, only to find the result of his immorality much worse than he expected. His penitential witness brings about a disturbing but absolutely convincing redemption. Few books have captured the painful death of spiritual rebirth in both characters as powerfully as Julian Green's The Other One. Then there's my favorite Catholic novel, Kristin Lovren's Daughter, by the Norwegian writer Sigrid Undset. I'm not sure if there's a greater Catholic novel than this one. If there is, it's probably your other medieval epic, The Master of Hesfiken. But I still prefer the more accessible Kristin. The first time I read Undset's trilogy, I was blessed with a very bad case of the flu, which kept me in bed for the entire read. My bouts with fever only intensified my connection with the unforgettable characters of Undset's story. Just as movie buffs will argue the comparative merits of Scarlett, Rhett, Melanie, and Ashley in Gone with the Wind, Undset fans delight in assigning degrees of responsibility to the impetuous Kristin, her father Lavrans, her warrior husband Erland, and her jilted fiancé, the Foursquare Simon. No other novel that I know explores the biblical themes of the wages of sin and the sins of the father as accurately and charitably as Kristin Lovren's Daughter. Its impact on the reader is witnessed in the novel's pivotal role in the life of Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Workers Movement, can demonstrate a moral reorientation reminiscent of Dante's Purgatorio. I was able to pay a spiritual debt to Undset by editing a book, Sigrid Undset on Saints and Sinners, containing previously untranslated writing and some very good critical essays. Then there's the comic novel, the very funny novel by the Catholic convert Walker Percy, Love in the Ruins. My reading into the church was not without its moments of laughter. This novel provided the perfect bridge from the existentialism of my graduate school days to the treasure of Catholic humanism. I thought it uncanny that Dr. Thomas More was found or placed by Walker Percy in a Dantean landscape, faced with Kierkegaardian choices that could be mediated only by a comic sacramental resolution given by a Catholic vision. It was as if Percy and his other novels confirmed this, had already experienced my philosophical and spiritual trials before I did. He understood that demons inhabited the suburbs of my childhood, and not just the cities and the country. Most will have heard of Wise Blood, the first novel by Flannery O'Connor. If you are familiar with the South, there is also plenty of laughter to be found in Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood. John Huston's underrated film of the novel catches many of these moments perfectly, such as when Hazel Motes, the main character, tells his landlady he is a preacher of the, quote, church without Christ. She then asks suspiciously, was that, quote, Protestant or something foreign? Indeed, O'Connor's novel is nothing less than a meditation on the loss of belief in Christ's active presence in the world through the church and its sacraments. That is, a meditation on the Protestant notion of the sacrament. Wise Blood made it clear to me why I was no longer content with the typical Protestant quarterly communion of grape juice done, quote, in memory of me. Under the Star of Satan was written by the French novelist Georges Bernanos. If O'Connor is one of those authors who puts you in the uncomfortable presence of the supernatural, Georges Bernanos is another. It's too bad that Diary of a Country Priest is his only novel that stays in print because the others are just as powerful. Under the Star of Satan is primarily about the special vocation of the priesthood and its sacramental blessing on all of us. We follow the protagonist, Abbé Donaisson, modeled on Jean-Marie Vianney, the Curé d'Ars, as he struggles for the soul of his parishioners, spending hour after hour in the confessional. In the Diary of a Country Priest, we see his gift of unlocking the heaviest heart and the price he must pay for it. In the midst of the priest's battles, we are also reminded not to take the metaphysical notion of evil as privation so literally as to count its active presence in the world. A film has been made of this novel, but not as successfully as Wise Blood. Robert Bresson's film, The Diary of a Country Priest, ranks as one of the most spiritually compelling films ever made, but not the most entertaining. There are six of the novels that made me Catholic. There are many others from which I could choose and recommend to you, novels written by the likes of J.F. Powers, Edward O'Connor, and John Hassler. The Canadian writer Morley Callahan, a friend and sparring partner of Ernest Hemingway, deserves a revival. The fiction of the English writer Muriel Spark grows in stature as time passes. In fact, we are witnessing a modest revival of good Catholic fiction from Alice Thomas Ellis, Torgny Lindgren, Ron Hansen, Pierce Paul Reed, and the late Ralph McInerney. We can only pray that books such as theirs will be found upon the path of some pilgrim finding a way home. We'll be back in just a moment after this brief message. I'll continue to read from my conversion memoir, the chapter entitled Beauty and Conversion.
Just carry your cross. That's a phrase I've heard many times throughout my life, especially while complaining about unjust and unfair people. Most recently, I've been expressing my frustration regarding people who are difficult, mean, or downright bullies. And as I was sharing with someone an ongoing problem with a certain individual, my friend said to me, "Just carry your cross." Now, his simple comments really had me thinking. Perhaps God put me in the situation to bring me close to Him. And instead of constantly complaining about how this person has and continues to wrong me, perhaps I need to carry the cross in silence. Sometimes we need to bind our sufferings with that of Christ as we carry our own burdens. So the next time you have the urge to express anger or frustration, just stop the complaining and carry the cross. This has been a Christ-Centered Communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the Communication Evangelist.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. St. Albert the Great Parish in Dearborn Heights invites you to the Infant of Prague Triduum, January 10th through the 12th. Father Ben Lutke will conduct this three-day devotion to the Infant of Prague, which will include Mass each day with special homilies, benediction, rosary, and more. For further details, call 313-770-3203. Join Ave Maria radio host Al Cresta on Wednesday, January 14th at St. Patrick's Church in Brighton. Nearing the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, Al will be discussing the aftermath of legalized abortion and what we can do to effect change. A Q&A session will follow his presentation. Call 661-805-3655 for more information. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Chapter 18, Contrasting Aesthetics. At the time of my conversion, I was accused by various friends of converting for aesthetic reasons. Even if I harbored such motives, the more masses I went to, the more I realized they didn't measure up to the midnight masses televised from the Vatican. In fact, liturgical practice I found so bad, the lousy music, the weak homilies, the half-hearted gestures, I came to see an irony in the experience of beauty that had lured me into the church. At least in the liturgies I was attending, with the exception of St. Ignatius Loyola in New York City, where my family attended for years, the masses seemed more dispirited than what I expected. Yes, I first learned to love Catholicism from books and would inevitably be disappointed by my actual participation in the daily life of the Church. Expectations raised by the glories of Dante, Aquinas, Newman, and Maritain are soon disappointed by contemporary parish architecture, sloppiness in liturgical execution, inattentive congregants, the lack of fellowship compared to evangelicals, and most important, the increasing approximation of Protestant worship and piety in many Catholic parishes. In recent years, there have been various attempts to revitalize the sense of community in Catholic parishes. These programs sometimes turn the sanctuary into a fellowship hall in the manner of evangelicals, forgetting the reverence owed the presence in the tabernacle of Christ. Catholics must learn to meet and greet people naturally, without imitating an evangelical style that does not belong to the Catholic liturgy. Evangelicals have been throwing parties in the churches for decades. Catholics don't have a clue how to do it and should stop trying. The older generation of Catholics were used to attending Mass quietly, without much participation. But there were other opportunities in these older, more tightly knit communities to create and enjoy friendship, such as the parish school. Where these institutions no longer exist, the younger generations are understandably finding it difficult to engender the warmth of fellowship that they can find at the Baptist church across the street. These concerns bother me less now, since they betray a Protestant penchant for making the reality of worship and church life in general dependent on the enthusiasm and skilled execution of the preacher or congregation. If I understand the meaning of the Mass, its reality is in no way dependent upon the skill or charisma of the celebrant, although it may benefit from both in its aesthetic power to claim our attention. Perhaps I was having trouble getting used to the reception of the Catholic Mass, which is basically the same from week to week during ordinary time. Kierkegaard, after all, had warned me against the impossibility of, quote, aesthetic repetition, meaning that the repetition of the same experience rarely produces the pleasure it induced the first time. Baptist and all evangelically tinged Protestant churches avoid the problem of aesthetic repetition with the personality and charisma of the minister. A powerful homily always leads to Sunday afternoon dinner conversation devoted to evaluating the performance of the pastor, the success of worship depending upon his eloquence. The Protestant pastor bears a heavy burden to the original, creative, and innovative. The Catholic priest depends only on the sacramental nature of the Eucharistic act. He does not have to stage to compete with MTV the way megachurches now have with projection screens, lights, and high-power audio. The priest simply repeats the ancient words. Protestant worship seems to be much more preoccupied with the aesthetics of the personalities and charisms, while the Mass, although enjoying aesthetic form, remains exactly the same regardless of time, place, or person. Thus, the reality of Jesus Christ remains the same for all of us at all times, regardless of our transient feelings or our capacity for attention. Protestant worship, with its entire focus on the preaching of the Word, unwittingly promotes the cult of the pastor's personality or his brilliance, which explains why Protestant churches rise and fall with the coming and going of their minister. Great burden for the Protestant pastor to bear without the objectivity of the Eucharistic act to celebrate. This probably explains why their sermons are so articulate. They have to be. Of course, these criticisms of Protestant worship are aimed at the deeper level of the articulated and unarticulated Baptist credo, the Protestant suspicion of embodiment, especially into space, of the holy and all its too pessimistic fear of idols. For Protestants, the word in time is trusted, the spoken word, as if it were more living for its momentary duration, like that passing wind of the Holy Spirit. This orientation toward inspired and charismatic personality is synonymous with the direction of modern life and the influence of the media on our standards of judgment. Often the Catholic Church and its worship will seem medieval or uninteresting by comparison. For me, it has taken some time getting used to. There are times I miss the full-throated hymn singing of a Baptist congregation, especially on Easter morning. My wife had to grab my sleeve once in a suburban New York parish on Easter when I was so upset that no one was singing Jesus Christ is Risen Today that I was going to walk into the aisle and say so. No kidding. The Mass is a ritual in time of sanity and calm where no one should expect to be entertained and no one should mistake the adrenaline of religious enthusiasm for creedal certainty. The worst thing the Catholic Church could do is give the Mass away to those who want to jazz it up by stealing our silence. At least a lackluster liturgy keeps us from the heresy of emotivism, that is, identifying our feeling states with our beliefs. It is liturgical celebration of the Eucharist that ensures avoidance of aesthetic dialectics, quote, making things interesting or relevant. Catholic liturgy resists the encroachment of enthusiasms and personal charisms that come and go, claiming to make everything alive, real, authentic, true again. The Mass is freedom from the cult of feeling, the equation of truth with the intensity of sensation or heightened self-awareness. The same problems that I find at the heart of Protestant worship I also find in its theology, piety, and ecclesiology. Each of the problems is in the same way associated with a resurgent subjectivity, a misplaced trust in the inspired individual, whether pastor or layman. Theologically, this is seen in the Protestant, quote, priesthood of the believer, with its implicit promotion of anyone's inspired relationship to the Bible. In this piety and spiritual formation, one finds inspired individuals who are free to proclaim that God told them to do such and such, and no one has the authority to say otherwise. The effect of this constant underground of enthusiasm, as Catholic historian calls it in his unparalleled intellectual history of Europe, plays havoc in the life of the Church, eventually emerging as the Protestant movement led by the monk Martin Luther. The lack of theological authority, other than personal readings of the Scriptures, naturally leads to myriad interpretations, each spawning its own church, which is inevitably doomed by its own substructure to spawn a few more. Of course, the typical response to all of this is a series of questions concerning the nature and legitimacy of the Catholic hierarchical authority. The major flaw in these questions is that they fail from the beginning to see these institutions as gifts to us, gifts that we need for life on earth, for spiritual growth. Instead, they are seen as unnecessary impediments to our freedom, as if mere potentiality were valuable in itself. And even worse, it is as if the very means afforded to us by God for our peace and joy were being rejected so that we can do it for ourselves and be more authentic and less childish. I am speaking here of the authority of the sacraments, the priest, and the power of the magisterium and the Holy Father. Occam's razor does not apply to the things of the Spirit that have come as gifts, not as logical necessities. Nonetheless, even these things of the Spirit are ratified by common sense. One can see this especially concerning confession. How many therapists would be put out of business if we took advantage of this great opportunity? The priests, the confessional, the Eucharist, the Pope himself are all gifts to us in the same way that prayer is. And indeed, the same argument is made against prayer in favor of meditation, the latter being a way of, quote, getting in touch with yourself without having to look towards some transcendent being when it is actually your own being you are concerned about. The principle of the Incarnation is at stake in all of this. Whether we believe that God has become flesh to be among us is the issue. Protestants allow God, his historical presence in the Church, his body, a concept that has more than biblical warrant to satisfy the most ardent skeptic. The Church is the body of Christ. This perhaps sums up what I have found in Catholicism that I did not find in Protestantism. The Protestant insistence on inspired enthusiasm and charism, rather than on revealed deposited doctrine, on scriptures apart from their interpretation by the Church in history, denies the actual real presence of Christ in the church. Chapter 19, Julian Green. Julian Green is well known in France, but familiar to very few in the United States. Green was born in 1900 to an American mother from Savannah, Mary Hartridge Green, and a French father. His bond with his Southern Calvinist mother, whose father was a Confederate officer, was extremely close, though she died when he was only 14. In spite of becoming perhaps the most cosmopolitan writer in a cosmopolitan city, Paris, he kept a large Confederate flag on the wall of his apartment on the Rue de Vannes. He once described himself as, quote, a Southerner lost in Europe, regardless of what I do. Julian Green published 18 novels before he died in 1998. His many volumes of journals made his private life one of the most public in France and constitute a cultural history of Paris during his lifetime. He became the first American citizen to be admitted to the Académie Française, taking the place of the great Catholic author François Mauriac, who Green eulogized upon his entry. Green converted to Catholicism soon after the death of his mother, but over the course of his long life, his chosen faith would constantly be struggling against his own sexual tendencies toward other men. He was outside of the church for 20 years in his early life, and though he never lost faith, he could not pray. Of all the novelists I read on my way into the church, none touched me more deeply than Julian Green. I'm ashamed to admit that I had to rely on translations of his, for I am told his French is very beautiful. But thanks to artful translators, including his sister Anne, I was introduced to a fictional landscape of faith and sexuality that allowed me, for the first time, to comprehend erotic desire in the context of divine creation. As a passage from Green's diaries reads, quote, "What I have against a life of pleasure is that it kills in a man all aptitude for love. It gives him the heart of a eunuch." I said this to someone who was piqued by my remarks, but I feel strongly that I'm right. Julian Green continues, "Nothing is colder than a pleasure-loving man. This is perceptible only in the long run because during youth there exists the eternal misunderstanding about desire and love, which are taken one for the other. Love is not necessarily linked to desire. It surpasses it continually. But love is not to be met every day. It does not run about the streets. In fact, that is precisely what it never does." Julian Green wrote that in 1955. Love surpasses desire because, as Green showed me, love is finally directed at God. Most of his novels reflect a desire between sexual desire and the love for God, a battle that often leads his characters toward violence and suicide. The source of Green's scrutiny on this subject is surely his mother's Puritanism, so graphically described in his journals and memoirs. Though it's easy to recognize the author's preoccupations in the actions of his characters, his novels are in no way written to express a Catholic message. Green, the Catholic writer, remains artfully hidden, and his characters, which Green once said he prayed for, are substantially drawn and memorable. I read all of his novels available in translation, including Moira, Each in His Own Darkness, The Congressor, but as I've said earlier, it was the other one that held the greatest meaning for me. Here, Green treats the story of Roger, who returns to the scene of his seduction of a young woman named Karen to seek her forgiveness. But finding that her life has been filled with a series of degradations, including a loss of faith during the German occupation of Denmark, Roger feels entirely responsible for her ruin. Green's narration looks at the seduction and its aftermath from the differing points of view of the seducer and the seduced. The seduction part is itself told by Roger, while Karen relates Roger's return 10 years later to receive her forgiveness. Roger's seduction of the innocent Karen is deliberately destructive, not only of her virginity, but also of her faith. Karin, who knows she is being used, is helpless to avoid him. What taints his seduction, however, is not the boredom that follows sexual conquest, but his knowledge that she gave in to his aggression knowingly. Roger wanted his desire to overwhelm his prey, but Karin's choice to leave the church and sleep with Roger mitigates his satisfaction. Years later, when Roger returns to find the now ruined Karin, she muses on the difference between sexual desire in men and women. She says, "Deep down, my sensuality was no more than a thirst for affection. It was this that had been quenched by the physical frenzy. With that annihilating joy, would I have folded my arms, which now held no one, around a being I could cherish. There was something in me that refused to make of a man an instrument of sexual pleasure. My soul demanded much more than that. Surely every woman would understand me. Is it our fault if their constant pangs of bodily hunger throw men into a state nearing madness? Because it is with half-mad people that we have to deal. If they could only see themselves at certain moments. As for women, they never entirely lose their heads and can only observe the appalling misunderstanding when they see their lust trying to pass itself off as love." Few writers treat the relation of sex to salvation and sanctity as deftly as Julian Green. Sexual yearning did not belong to some nether world of physical needs, but was part of the desire for God himself. Thus, Green's fiction fleshes out the oft-quoted restless heart of St. Augustine. Some religious leaders would rather read about the restless heart in the abstract than be exposed to the sinners of Green's fiction or to sinners actually. These readers, who tend to view all art through a moral prism before allowing themselves to enjoy it, consider stories like that of Roger and Karin an occasion of sin rather than an occasion of spiritual insight. Their reticence puts them in a difficult situation regarding the Catholic novel and many other great novels, since so much important Catholic fiction revolves around an incident of adulterous seduction. Brideshead Revisited, Christian Lauren's Daughter, Wise Blood, Graham Greene's The End of Affair, to name only a few. Green himself, with his own Puritan upbringing, was alive to this irony. He wrote, "Drag a writer away from his sin and he no longer writes." This, I admit, is a horrible statement to put into words. Is sin necessary to his works? Who would dare say such a thing? Remove sin and you remove the works. Are the works necessary? You might as well ask if a writer is necessary. He is inasmuch as God wishes him to exist. I can withdraw from the world, as I so often am tempted to do, but then no more works. Now I believe that I came into this world to write books and to reach a few people. Julian Green wrote that in 1954. The greatest of Catholic poets, Dante, was also aware that his readers might raise the question. So he answered them at the beginning of his Divine Comedy. He wrote, "Midway the path of life that men pursue, I found me in a darkling wood astray, for the direct way had been lost of view. Ah, me, how hard a thing it is to say, what was this thorny, wild with intricate, whose memory renews the first dismay? Scarcely in death is bitterness more great, but as concerns the good discovered there, the other things I saw I will relate." These other things are what make so many morally earnest religious readers cringe when reading fiction or viewing theater, film, painting, or sculpture. But it is clear from the history of Christian art that Green is absolutely correct. Avoid the sin and you kill the creative imagination of the artist. The artist has been deprived of the material cause of his creation. The Catholic tradition, to its credit, has always recognized this, and thus many artists have found a home there. Puritanism, in any guise, even when it quotes Thomas Aquinas, kills the imagination and strips truth of its sensuous splendor. Chapter 19, Quick-Eyed Love. The composer Ray Vaughan Williams introduced me to a poem on love by George Herbert in his musical setting of The Five Mystical Songs. His song cycle remains among the most powerful marriages of worded music that I know of. And the Herbert poem beginning, "Love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back," contains for me just about everything that needs to be said about love. I'm just one of the many who have been moved by this poem, one of the three that Herbert dedicated to the theme of love. The Jewish-born philosopher and mystic Simone Weil said that she felt Christ's presence while reciting Herbert's poem, quote, "Christ himself came down and took me." She recited this poem so often that it became to her a prayer. For me, the poem sets out the basic problem of love in dramatic terms, the struggle between the self and others, whether our neighbors or God. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first interest in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. "A guest," I answered, "worthy to be here." Love said, "You shall be he." "I, the unkind, ungrateful, all my dear, I cannot look on thee." As a teenager, I was drawn to the communion of Southern Baptists by their strong sense of fellowship, their congregational singing, the impassioned personal prayers, and their forthright confession of moral fear and repentance. All this seemed an answer to my sense of being mired in selfishness, which was, in various ways, reinforced by the common unhappiness of my ordinary middle-class upbringing. I sought a way out of my preoccupation with myself and the exuberant generosity of the local Baptist church offered that, but there was a drawback. Among my Baptist friends, one kind of unworthiness was addressed, but another was put in its place. The basic moral unworthiness, guilty of dust and sin, was replaced by a kind of metaphysical unworthiness. Evangelicals view human nature as fallen, and the work of grace as extrinsic to an unredeemable human nature. In other words, I was asked to live in a radically divided world, described best in Luther's words, "at once justified, at once a sinner." This hard distinction leads, I believe, to the evangelical mistrust of human works of all kinds, not just claims to good works, but to the works of culture, the arts, philosophy, the humanities. Philosophy was studied among Baptists primarily to find out what was lacking in it, how it was in basic discord with Scripture. There was no spirit of cooperation, no instinct to wed the truth of philosophy to revealed truth. My conversion did not miraculously cure my problem of self-absorption. I am still converting, no longer from evangelicalism, but from stubborn self-regard that we all share in our fallen human nature. Conversion never ends, even for those who have always felt at home in the church. I leave it to others, my friends and family, to evaluate my progress. What I know is that I have been given every possible opportunity to enter the body of Christ. As in the George Herbert poem, love has never abandoned me, never accepted my excuses or let me run away. At each turn, I have heard her say, "You must sit down and taste my meat." Between that verse and the next, "So I did sit and eat," there is a mysterious silence, missing link in the argument of the poem. Why did he sit and eat? Why did I? The silence exists because at the moment of turning toward God, all explanations fail. God fills in the silence. The lure of God's beauty, of his works, of those made by human hands, may stir the heart to seek him, but it fails to explain how he is found, or we are found by him. Converts such as I can point to signs and wonders along the way of their journey with gratitude and with hope that others will be similarly moved. But their stories themselves testify to the multitude of ways that God makes himself present to our eyes and ears. What remains universal, however, is that God came down, that he comes down every day and beckons us in him to rest. I want to thank the listeners for bearing with me as I read from a book of my own, my conversion memoir, an American conversion, one man's discovery of beauty and truth in times of crisis. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed very much remembering all those great gifts that brought me into our church.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Are you prejudiced? Whether white or black, do we fear one another? Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews this weekend to discuss this question with Deacon Larry Oney. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m., encoring on Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, in the Eastern Church's Epiphany is the observance of the baptism of Christ. It is called Theophany, and water is blessed on these days and used to sanctify many things.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
The church exists to evangelize, and we, by our baptismal promises, are charged to carry out that work. On our next Putting on the Mind of Christ program, Peter Herbeck gives us some tools for our work.
One of the central things Pope Paul VI did was this. He said what he wanted us to do, to come to grips again with a deep understanding of what evangelization is. He said this, evangelizing is in fact the grace and vocation that's proper to the church. It's her deepest identity. She exists to evangelize. This is her raison d'etre. This is why the church exists. So he underlined that very clearly. So why is it the reason the church exists?
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Don't miss Peter Herbeck addressing our responsibilities and our part in the new evangelization. Listen to If Not You, Then Who on our next edition of Putting on the Mind of Christ. It's heard every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on Ave Maria Radio and on the internet at avemariaradio.net.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
The Sunday after Christmas is the Feast of the Holy Family, and the Gospel tells of Jesus getting lost in the temple, which he called his Father's house, and eventually being found by his parents after a three-day search. Parenting is hard work, even if you have the perfect son. So parents, know that Mary and Joseph can sympathize with your many anxieties. Each year, Jesus' parents went up to Jerusalem for Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up according to their custom. And when they were returning, the boy Jesus remained behind in Jerusalem, but his parents didn't know it. Thinking that he was in the caravan, they journeyed for a day, looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances, but not finding